Authorities in Chicago announced today they will charge a police officer with first-degree murder in the shooting death of a 17-year-old African-American man. Tomorrow, the city will release a video of the shooting, footage that authorities worry will lead to protests.
Last night, five people were shot in Minneapolis outside a police precinct where protesters had gathered for over a week after the police shooting of Jamar Clark. Police shot and killed the young, unarmed African-American man after a struggle with officers following his interference with paramedics who were trying to help an assault victim.
And today is the one-year anniversary of a Missouri grand jury's decision to not charge a police officer for the shooting death of an unarmed black teen in Ferguson. There have been several other high-profile cases. In Baltimore, Freddie Gray died in police custody. A reserve deputy in Oklahoma shot and killed an unarmed black man. And here in Wisconsin, there have been protests over the police-involved shootings of Tony Robinson in Madison and Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee.
Chad Dion Lassiter is here to talk about the relationships between police and African-American communities and protests like the Black Matter movement, Black Lives Matter movement. Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
Well, take us back, if you would, to a year ago when the grand jury in Missouri announced that they wouldn't press charges against the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager. What happened?
Well, I think the grand jury got it wrong. I think when you look at what happened to happened in Ferguson, just the trauma that existed in that community, given the context of the death of Michael Brown. Once again, we don't want to say all police officers, but I think we learned a lot from Ferguson with regards to the Department of Justice report. I think we also understand fundamentally that we have to get these type of cases out of the hands of regular grand jurors, but we need to put it in the hands of an independent federal prosecutor where there can potentially be some equity. And when we also look at some of the challenges that we're seeing now is that we still continue to see this anthology of police brutality by some police officers vis-a-vis black males, which continues to be alarming.
And this movement was a pivotal one for the Black Lives Matter movement. It had started before Ferguson, going back to the Trayvon Martin shooting. But a year ago in Ferguson, what was the Black Lives Matter movement like then?
Well, I think it was just now getting to formulate and conceptualize how it was going to approach the killing of black males with impunity by the state. I think there seems to be some misconceptions about the Black Lives Matter movement in the sense that some want to say that it's radical, that it calls for the killing and the harming of police officers. But let's make no mistake, the Black Lives Matter movement is a coalition of not just black individuals, but also white individuals and others who are standing up to simply say, let's look at some of the challenges that are happening in our democracy vis-a-vis police officers and the African-American community, and for that matter, communities of color in general.
And how do you see that Black Lives Matter movement changing since Ferguson a year ago?
I see them actually getting more individuals involved. I would imagine that some of the challenges we saw in Oklahoma with students uniting against the racist chant on the bus by the fraternity, what's happening in Missouri, the students who are doing sit-ins and civil disobedience protests at Princeton University and all over the country, I think the Black Lives Matter movement has served as a catalyst for individuals and specifically students to find their voice within the confines of some aspects of structural inequality. I think that it's amazing that students on all sides of the color line and gender line are standing up and speaking back to the powers that be.
And in terms of reaching real recognizable benchmarks, how effective has it been?
Well, I don't have any qualitative and quantitative data as a social scientist and researcher to speak to that aspect of things. One of the things I do know is that aspects of the Black Lives Matter movement have met with Bernie Sanders. They have met with Hillary Clinton and others. But I do want to say that there is a current in the country where young people on all sides of the color line and gender line are speaking up. You see students in China who are saying Black Lives Matter. In Brazil, Black Lives Matter. There was a student protest at a high school in Berkeley, California. 2,000 white students came out of the school and they did a protest, Black Lives Matter. And so in our democracy, when we say, well, no, all lives matter, Black Lives Matter is just a political rallying cry. that simply says Black Lives Matter in the midst of, you know, white supremacy shootings and killings by some police officers. We've always known that all lives matter, but in our democracy, we know from three-fifths, from slavery to Jim Crow to chattel slavery in this present time of the new Jim Crow, that black lives have not mattered. And sometimes they haven't mattered to even black people vis-a-vis some of the violence that we see and the intra-conflicts in our urban areas.
The University of Pennsylvania's Chad Dion Lassiter is with us now to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement 1 year after a grand jury decided not to indict the officer involved in the shooting death of black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And since that time, there have been several more high-profile fatal shootings of young African-American men by police officers over the last year. And just in recent months, we've been hearing again in stories out of Minneapolis, stories out of Chicago. How have these shootings affected the cities and communities where they happen? And has anything unfolded differently since Ferguson?
I think what we've seen is we've seen a wider divide with regards to the trust versus mistrust. I always like to look at these things from a mental health perspective. We're always talking about how these communities can get back to a sense of normalcy, but we don't actually talk about how we can deploy social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, trauma counselors to deal with the trauma of, one, the individuals who have lost their loved one, i.e. black mothers, black fathers, the black community, brown communities. And we also don't talk about how those young people will not be in the classroom with some of their classmates, i.e. Mike Brown, Jordan Davis, you know, and the list just goes on and on. I think what we've also seen is we've seen an increase of tension, because now there are times where we're starting to paint all police officers the same. And there are a lot of police officers who put their lives on the line every day for humanity, not knowing if they're going to come back home to their respective families or to their respective communities. And so we see a lot of those challenges. But we know that there are still some gross inequalities in Baltimore. We see it in Ferguson. It's in Chicago. It's in Philadelphia. It's in Detroit. And so we really have to look at all these things that lead to some of these challenges in the community: economic violence, educational inequality, a lost economy, hopelessness, despair, and also institutional racism.
Would you say that the trust between some African-American communities and some police departments has gotten more intense, the trust issues, I should say, or is it still a problem that's maybe getting worse before it gets better?
Great question. I think it's actually getting worse. But this is not anything that's new. Earlier when I talked about the anthology of police brutality, you can go back to the 50s where individuals were just simply trying to go to school or sit at a Woolworths counter or get on a bus. And that's where you get the institutional racism from, because it was prejudice plus power that led to the institutional policy that said you can't come to this library, only whites can, or you have to go to that water fountain that says colored only. And so some of these children came up hearing those narratives, and they see those narratives maybe from a family member who shows them the eye on the prize, and white students of consciousness have also heard from their grandmothers and their grandfathers of how they were freedom riders, where you had German shepherds biting the breasts of women, to this era that we're in where black males are having their hands up and they're still being killed. What is it about the psyche of some white police officers where they see black males as the boogeymen, or they see them as intimidating, where you're not shooting to just simply maim, but you're shooting to kill, and you're unloading and you're reloading? And so that becomes problematic. And so, yes, there is a challenge around trust versus mistrust. Some communities are trying to, you know, get in front of community policing. They're starting to hold town halls and forums where they can talk about the issues of trust versus mistrust on all sides. We don't want to say all police officers, but we also want police officers to not look at all black males as from a criminality standpoint.
So you mentioned the relationship that has to happen, that's evolving between some police departments, some African-American communities, and also these structural issues of racial inequality a year out from Ferguson again today. Is this an evolving story? Has any progress been made?
Some progress has been made, but I think the biggest challenge is what we're seeing now is this whole aspect of white racial consciousness and white anxiety from some whites that America pretty soon is going to be brown. and that whites are going to be in the minority. And so I think there's some psychological outfalling and outpouring of just some disdain around that when you hear some of the rhetoric that you witness and you see firsthand from Donald Trump. And we think that he's a mere sideshow, but Donald Trump needs to be taken seriously because he can, in fact, end up being the president of the United States, as homophobic, as xenophobic, and as insensitive that he is. But I think one of the things that we need to really look at is we need to have a frank conversation about structural inequality. We need not look at, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement as a movement that is threatening. They're not like the Tea Party. They're not like the Ku Klux Klan. No one from the Black Lives Matter movement has desecrated a synagogue or a church, burned a cross. We do know that we've had some uprisings, but that has not been the individuals from the Black Lives Matter movement. That have been individuals in Ferguson and Baltimore who have been fed up with the structural inequality and some of the tension. So we have to do a better job in the mental health profession and just as a society to say we don't want people dumping that anger out on property or on personhood. But the question that we have to ask ourselves Socratically is what do people do with that pain and frustration? We want them to do something constructively, but King himself said that riots are the language of the unheard.
We're talking right now to national race relations expert Chad Dion Lassiter, talking about the Black Lives Matter movement on the one-year anniversary of the announcement that no charges would be filed against a police officer who shot an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you've seen from the Black Lives Matter movement? Have you participated in maybe a recent protest on racial equality issues? What do you think that police departments around the country could do to help rebuild trust between officers and minority communities? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with University of Pennsylvania professor Chad Dion Lassiter about the Black Lives Matter movement.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Black Lives Matter? Are you part of Black Lives Matter? Have you participated in protests or seen them? What do you think about this, and what do you think needs to change when it comes to issues of racial inequalities in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Callers now, we have Amy with us in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. Last week I was at the holiday tree lighting in Milwaukee at Red Arrow Park, where they were supposed to be holding a vigil at the same time as the tree lighting for Dontre Hamilton. It ended up in a full-blown, you know, protest. And there were children, you know, singing Christmas carols that they had been practicing for weeks. And these Black Lives Matter, these Black Lives Matter people were, you know, throwing, you know, a huge protest. Like, it wasn't the right time, and I think it makes their organization look just, you know, not very civilized.
Amy, thank you so much for calling with your thoughts about the incident that happened in Milwaukee at a tree lighting ceremony. And I realize on the other side of that matter, there were those who said that maybe that park was no longer the appropriate place for a celebration like that, having been a death so recently. But Chad Dion Lassiter, what do you say to situations like that that I'm sure will continue to happen?
Well, I respect the caller. And, you know, just from her vantage point, how she viewed it. But it's interesting that she used the word linguistically, made them look like they weren't civilized. Maybe she doesn't recognize this, but in the larger scope of things in our society, it's always amazing how we deem some civilized versus uncivilized, human versus subhuman. Maybe the park served as a metaphor for individuals who recognized that a life was lost at that park. And maybe this wasn't a time to be singing Christmas carols, that everything is not jubilee, everything is not, you know, touchy-feely, tiptoe through the tulips and, you know, a wonderful time. Let's celebrate Christmas. There's a lot of pain that still exists. Michael Brown's mother has pain. Jordan Grant's mother has pain. Jordan Davis' mother, and all these mothers and fathers and communities have pain. I don't want us to get so caught up in just looking at this from a Black Lives Matter perspective, because when we say Black Lives Matter, it denotes that it's just Black people fighting for equality. There are white people who are part of this Humanity Matters movement that is addressing Black lives being killed by the state and sanctioned by the state, by some white police officers killing Black males. We're not asking for the killing of white males, but we do not see white males losing their lives in our democracy at the hands of white police officers or Black police officers. And when white males do engage in, criminal behaviors in school shootings, or Dylan Ruth, who walks into a church and massacres 9 people, we're looking at it from a biopsychosocial perspective, where Black males are seen as the problem.
And Chad, earlier before we went to the break, you were talking about some of your concerns about what to do with the emotional health issues that are arising from some of these scenarios we're talking about, anger and fear. And you mentioned yourself that on the one hand, you have police officers and departments feeling embattled right now. And on the other hand, members of the African-American community feeling expendable and targeted. So How does one, as a society, I guess, dealing with those issues that arise at that juncture between those two?
Well, you all know I've been on your show several times over the past 5 years, and I'm not going to use this opportunity to placate, ingratiate, or display with false generosity as if I know the answer to that, because I don't. One of the things I would suggest is that the police departments in our urban areas, suburban and rural areas, begin to embark upon anti-racism training. Cops need to look at male privilege. Communities need to also recognize that they can't have it both ways. You can't say that you disrespect the police or you don't trust the police, but yet you want to also call the police when you're in danger. I think we have to have communications. I think that we have to look at the hyper-masculinity that exists between some police officers and some people in the community, specifically males of color and police officers who are not of color. I think we also have to ask ourselves, who polices the police? And so they maintain a blue wall of silence of the status quo oftentimes. And you have white police officers who do want to come forward and say, hey, listen, my partner planted those drugs, but he also has to think about what happens when he goes out into the community with that same partner. You have Black police officers who I want to ask them a question directly. How do you feel about Black males being gunned down by white police officers when more often than not they've been found with no weapon? We've yet to hear that, and I think that is one of the things that adds to the fragmentation in our communities.
We're talking right now to the University of Pennsylvania's Chad Dion Lassiter, talking about the Black Lives Matter movement 1 year after a grand jury decided not to indict the officer involved in the shooting death of Black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And we'll go back to our phones now. We have Lori with us in Stevens Point. Lori, hi.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good evening.
I really, really enjoy listening to your insight. I would like to address, I believe it comes down to training with our officers. At some point, there's been a shift, because it does seem more of a militarized training aspect. And I guess maybe I come from a generation that saw police officers as someone who's supposed to come onto the scene and be the voice of reason. And we all know from seeing the videos of all of these victims in the last year, we all see what's happened. We all saw the hands were up. The gentleman maybe was walking away or was exercising his rights verbally to the officer, saying, no, you cannot do this to me. And you have to wonder if maybe it's time to put two cops in the cars now so that there's the balance. And I don't know if there's annual training or semi-annual training for officers to pass psychological tests, or how are they doing. It's an extremely stressful job. Officers are necessary in our society. But I have to wonder, when you're dealing with so much of a lot of unpleasant things in life, what toll that takes. And maybe it's time to get out of the car and go into the office, or, is there a rotation? I really, truly believe that it's It comes down to training.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Lori. Chad, what do you say?
I think the caller is remarkable. I wish I could jump through the phone and, with her permission, high-five her and hug her, because she's absolutely right. Police officers deal with post-traumatic stress disorder as well. They deal with fear. Sometimes they're dealing with challenges that they may have at home, and there's a countertransference that happens while they're out in the street. I think they go oftentimes without debriefing about some of the horrific and horrible situations and deplorable situations that they sometimes walk into. I have a colleague here in Philadelphia who's a police officer who one time went in the house and talked about how the baby was a newborn and had maggots all over her body. And so they see a lot of things. So I think there is the training. I think there is debriefing. And I think that we have to look at the racial stereotypes that exist. When we look at Ferguson as a case study, Darren Wilson said that, you know, Mike Brown was coming to him and he looked like the Incredible Hulk. That's almost similar to saying he looked like King Kong, deeply rooted in the Birth of a Nation with D.W. Griffith, where black males were brute. Okay, but Darren Wilson was 6'4". He has the gun, he has the badge, and he has the authority on his side. But yet he's scared. So you buy into that narrative. When these police officers are killing people like Walter Scott down in Charleston, South Carolina, and I think all black people are, you know, just simply saying, is give us the benefit of the doubt. Eric Garner, if he committed a crime by selling Lucy cigarettes, arrest him. If he didn't want to be arrested, then bring someone on the scene that can talk to him. But don't kill him, because that's trauma looking at that video. Dylan Ruth killed 9 people. He walks out in handcuffs. Ted Bundy, the Unabomber, so forth and so on. Sean Bell, he gets ran over by a police officer vehicle. And the only thing we talk about was he was at a strip club the night before his wedding. And so it just has to be equity on all sides. It's not all police officers, but we also need to say it's not all black males and it's not all males of color.
And just briefly, as we wrap up here, where do you see this movement going next and the American conversation about police and minority communities?
I don't know where the Black Lives Matter movement is going next. I think our democracy has an opportunity at this very moment to turn it into a movement where on all sides of the color line and gender line, we have a frank conversation about not being homophobic, not being transphobic, not engaging in irrational hatred. I think that we need to express how we may have a dislike for something. And maybe it's because we're xenophobic, but not a disdain that leads to irrational hatred. I wish that more people recognize and fundamentally understand that the Black Lives Matter movement is also comprised of white students and white individuals who are concerned for black humanity as well.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
As always, thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, national expert on race relations and professor at the University of Pennsylvania.